breast milk. The eyes wide or weighty with it, the full boat or low tide of it, the leopard of it when it leaps. Nervous before a sermon, Saint Bernard prayed for help, and the Virgin appeared, babe in lap, to squirt him in the eye with a wondrous stream of it, thus gifting him with eloquence. The sun-white glow of it in dimmed down rooms across galaxies, galaxies, galaxies. The Romans admired a mother who visited her father, sentenced to starve to death in prison, and kept him alive with it, secretly, the leopard of it when it leaps. 10 children my great-grandmother nursed from one breast, the other side never made, maybe, a country doctor thought, because of her childhood polio. The creation ex nihilo of it, across the galaxy's pale cream. In a short story by Maupassant, a train is stopped far from anywhere, and one car holds 2 strangers, a very hungry man and a nursemaid, painfully engorged. And that's all you really need to know, except it occurs to me she must have been hungry too.
Well, friends, welcome to the Regeneration Podcast. And you just heard a beautiful poem, Breast Milk, by the great poet and one of my personal friends, Katie Hartsock. So, Katie Hartsock, welcome to the Regeneration Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Katie.
Oh, man. Mike, I like to tell stories.
Yeah. It's because I'm Irish. I like your stories.
So, I met Katie, I think, was it the first Jesus the Imagination? And
I would have been there. So, Katie, have we met? There was a dinner along,
table.
Okay.
This is email.
Mm-hmm.
This is when Mary Grove College.
So, I was thinking of the conference that led to,
And I get this email from this woman. It's a couple of great poems. And in fact, I think one of them is In Bed of Impatience, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And it was great poetry. And I just liked this, the way this person communicated. She felt like such a nice person. And then she emailed me again with a weird request.
Very weird.
That I could.
What's it going to be?
The sponsor and godfather of her father.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
Her husband, when he entered the church on Easter, which is, gosh.
I knew this, and still when I heard it again, it was weird. Yeah, even though I knew it. Yeah.
1 in 7. Yeah. 1 in 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Right after we moved here. And I'm like, well, I've never met you. But I could do it. I mean, I couldn't go because I had responsibility.
Well, it was Easter Vigil 2017.
Yeah. The big one.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I can't come. How about you guys come over to our house for Easter dinner? And they did. That's when I met Katie and John and Jonathan Geltner, who we've also had on the show a couple times.
We've had him on twice. Yeah.
And
he's a really, 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 really smart guy.
Baby Harlan.
And Harlan was still in a carrier.
Yeah. He was like 3 months by then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so. It was.
So if this was 2017, this is, you're now saying he's 6 years old or so? Or
he is. Yeah. Okay, he'll be seven next year. Yep.
And it was as though we'd always known each other.
It was. We just fell into step and conversation right away and like laughed at the same things and shared.
They were part of the family immediately.
It was really lovely. And like to contextualize the weird request, Jonathan had been reading Michael's work, his like sociology and like his.
How did he first find it, Katie? Jonathan, I'm sorry.
You know, Jonathan finds books. That's okay. Just what Jonathan does.
Yeah.
He just finds that's part of what he does. And I mean, I think he's really done enough reading to have earned a PhD in theology by now.
Yeah.
But he just reads as widely as he can, especially among religious philosophers. Mm-hmm. And so he came upon Michael's work, and he's also interested in. At that point, I don't know if he was even, or if the word was going around re-enchantment, but I think he's already on to that spirit, you know, of that search. And so he'd been meeting Michael's work. I found out about JTI. I thought, that's so cool. I'm going to send this guy some poems. And he very kindly took them. And John had a long and winding way into the church and into his baptism on Easter Vigil 2017. And we didn't know anyone to ask to be the godfather. And I thought, we were like kind of sitting on the couch thinking, and I was like, well, what about Michael Martin? He's like, are you crazy? We've never even met him. And I said, but you know, like you've read his books, like you do know him in the way that I think you get to know people when you read their books carefully and with love and appreciation. And I was like, so you do know him in a way. And I don't know.
It's a great story, though. It's a wild story. And I've heard it before. Yeah. So yeah. Again, sight unseen, you guys just called him.
Well, I wrote him, like, I think John wrote him an email and yeah. I said, or maybe I wrote the email.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was either going to accept being godfather or press charges for stalking. It was a drama. Were they going to go to jail, ladies and gentlemen, or were they going to have a new godfather?
Godfather. I thought to myself, well, the worst he can say is no.
Yeah, right.
And I was happy.
I would have to say that that was one of my favorite Easters when you guys walked through the door.
It was so joyful and sweet. And Michael, your family like welcomed us, even though these were these like probably weird strangers who had asked.
They acted like you've been there all the whole time, right?
It was really special and sweet.
It was. And we continue. Mm-hmm. So let's back up even farther. Now, Katie is an associate professor of English at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan.
Yeah, south of Rochester, New York.
Meadowbrook Theater,
yes.
Where they used to have a bluegrass festival there. I used to go to when I was a teenager. And I bet I saw Peter, Paul, and Mary there. I bet I saw them four times. And Pat Metheny, I think, I saw there. But anyway, Katie teaches there. And now you have a kind of wonderful, circuitous movement through school. I mean, you met John in college, right? Mm-hmm. In the University of Cincinnati, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I... I entered the University of Cincinnati as a classics major.
Do they still have a classics program?
They still do. In fact, wow. Cincinnati is one of the best ones.
Wow, awesome.
And, you know, you go to college, you're a freshman, you don't know. don't know that like these people are like world renowned in their field. So I think I only got to appreciate what I had after I'd left for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I kind of better realized like who I had studied with and but I eventually started taking creative writing classes. I had always been trying to write poetry. And then I started taking that more seriously. And the classics major then kind of shifted into a English major with creative writing and a classics minor. But Jonathan and I met in English classes. And
the two smartest kids in the class.
Well, we were competitors. And Professor Jonathan Kamholtz was our professor, and he used to, if someone said something smart, he would write it on the board, just to kind of, that, like, spurred us. We were like,
my name would never be on such a blackboard. But I think you two were, yeah.
Well, it was very good because he kind of spurred us on to say good things, you know, in class, like, oh, we had our words written on the board.
That's so interesting and cool.
It was cool. And
never heard of that before.
It's something I try to do too. I have whiteboards now, and they're usually covered by the enormous screen, but sometimes I still write things on the board, and I think it makes the students feel really special and like, oh, I said that. That means something.
I may have to start using that.
Yeah. Yeah. But we were competitors, and I did not like him at first. I thought he was kind of arrogant and a jerk.
Then you watched Wings of Desire. He was on for our show on Wings of Desire.
Exactly. Yeah. But we came around eventually, and that was a fun romp.
He toned it down eventually.
He did. Well, I don't know if he did that or I got used to it or something.
Hi Katie, how are you? Did you see the Yankees game last week?
And then so then you went from Chicago, from Cincinnati, you went to Chicago.
First I went to Ann Arbor, where I did my MFA in poetry.
Okay.
And at the same time, John went to Chicago and started working on a degree at UChicago. Right. And then I did go to Chicago and I worked at the Poetry Foundation for a while, which was great in a lot of ways.
What do you do at the Poetry Foundation?
I started off, I had a temp gig at one of the worst temp jobs. Well, I don't want to say one of the worst. There's probably far worse, but this was a pretty bad one. I was a temp at a storage facility at O'Hare, airport, where you couldn't even take the blue line, you know, because like there was no public transit. There wasn't anything connect the airport itself with where I had to go. And we specialized in really weird storage things, cadavers, for example, like bodies that had to be flown back internationally. So I was in this like windowless temp job with this terrible boss whose name was Henry Miller. And I remember thinking like the real Henry Miller would hate you so much.
Would he though, Katie? That's for another time. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, he was a doltish person.
Yeah. Okay.
Very not nice.
He would be so bored by him.
He'd be bored is probably.
That is a really interesting temp job though. You know, the way you described it. I was thinking, you know, she worked in a factory. No, this is pretty interesting. Yeah.
I couldn't wait to leave. And I got a phone call from a friend saying the Poetry Foundation needs someone to make photocopies for a day.
That's a win.
And I was like, I'm there. I'm there. And then I just kept thinking, what else can I do? And they kept me around and it became an internship and then it became a full-time job. So
nice. I didn't know that.
It's kind of like that, Michael, that director or the movie guy, and I'm forgetting his name, and he was excellent, who kind of got a gig working with Terrence Malick that way. He just kind of showed up on set, then he just hung around for a while.
No, so it was Reno.
Yeah, Reno Laurel. That was great. Yeah. Similar.
Yeah, you hang around, you're like, what else can I photocopy?
Yeah.
Very cool. Now, Joe Parisi wasn't there anymore, was he?
He had just left. Chris Wyman had just taken over for him. I got to know Chris and Danielle and, you know, eventually their girls as time went on.
So these names are foreign to me. These are all people. This is all an entity that produces the magazine Poetry or the journal Poetry.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And Chris Wyman was like now.
And they run the website. And
two editors ago. So, but he was the new editor at the time. And he's a beautiful poet. He writes about faith beautifully and questions. And, you know, I highly recommend his books to any listeners, his poetry and his prose. Beautiful.
So, and then you went from there back to Ann Arbor, right?
So after the Poetry Foundation, I went to Northwestern and got a PhD in comparative literature.
Oh, I thought it was at U of M.
Mm-mm. No, that was at Northwestern. And so I worked between the classics department and the English department and the comp lit. And I did this kind of very sprawling dissertation, thinking about how poets have always been retelling stories, and especially from a female perspective. And I compared how contemporary female poets and ancient male poets use the female perspective to like tell new versions of myth. So that was the dissertation. And then I got the job at Oakland because by then I had the first book coming out and I had the dissertation and I got the job at Oakland, and I was pregnant with Harlan. So it was a very big year. It was a very
big year. That's Oakland, exciting. Michigan.
Yeah, Oakland University in Michigan. Yep. Yeah, everyone always thinks, California.
They do.
I say, no. Michigan.
Well, that's a story. And that was a year. How about that for a year, right?
Yeah.
And at the time,
crazy ass job at an airport.
What year was it you moved to Ferndale?
We moved to Ferndale in the fall of 2016.
So yeah, Mary Grove College was still more or less open, which was that's only about 6 miles away from Mary Grove College where you were.
Right.
That's what they call BMC, before Mary Grove closing.
That's right.
It's a timeline. Yeah.
Before they, I don't get me good.
We got to study Michael's literature and books before Mary Grove closed.
Before they screwed up.
Right.
So here's the thing, and I have never asked you this question, and I'm glad to ask you right now. How did you become a poet?
Oh, I think I had, you know, Michael, in your book, there's a line that says, it says, if you have one kind of mother, this will happen to you. But then if you have the right kind of mother, you'll become a poet.
Yeah.
And I always remember that line because I think my family, like my mother, yes, but also her father, my grandfather, there was just a real love of language and songs, especially my grandfather was always singing songs. My mother was always singing songs and playing with language and telling stories. My dad also was kind of an amateur poet. And I think one of the first poems I memorized was one that he had written when he was like in high school, because he would show me that stuff. And so, yeah, I just kind of grew up thinking that the best thing to be would be a poet. And that's
it's true.
Yeah, I had a poem in Highlights magazine when I was like really? Six or something. Right. Wow. Yeah, I think it was called Werewolves Don't Go to Summer Camp.
I hope you still have it someplace.
You know, probably somewhere in
a box. File
in my mother's house exists. I don't know where it is now, but.
We could get it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next to like somebody's napkins, you know, scribbled with the lyrics to the next top 40.
Yes. Yes.
Well, so that's what led you into, I mean, I kind of grew up with this idea too. I think I'm a poet. I had no idea what that.
It was really like, I think that's what I am. And it was, and you know, even when I was reading poetry that I think I was trying to read above my level in high school, or maybe I hadn't been given the tools to read advanced poetry. And even if I didn't understand it, I was still like, this is important. Yeah. I don't know what it says, but this is important.
You can tell it's, yeah, me too. I mean, that's it, right? Yeah. I mean, you have to, I mean, at that age, you have to aim high.
Yeah.
And as a teacher, I mean, people always say, teach to the middle. And then, no. Teach to the top, and then everybody goes up.
I had great teachers in high school too, and I had a really cool English teacher. Her name was Miss Soul, S-O-L, and she always joked with our acronym humor going on here. She always joked it stood for shit out of luck. but she was like a real kind of gothic beauty in the middle of suburban Boardman, Ohio. She had this like raven long black hair and very like moody, beautiful person. And I should really try and find her. I'm sure she's still around somewhere, if not Boardman, Ohio. So,
so how did that, your journey is coming into grown up writing poetry? How did that happen?
Probably more teachers, you know, because I loved Latin in high school. And so I went to Cincinnati because I had this really wonderful classic scholarship. And then I started taking creative writing classes, and my took a class with Jim Cummins, who's a wonderful poet, and became like my poetry mentor, father, figure in poetry kind of a thing. And there were other great poets there too, Don Bogan, John Drury. I got to study with amazing people when I was an undergrad, because they let me take graduate level workshops when they were visiting poets. So I got to study with C.D. Wright, which was one of like the foundational experiences. I adore C.D. Wright, and she and we used to have these wild, I mean, so I say poetry, but also like wine, because the Cincinnati, and they probably don't do this anymore, when visiting poets would come, they would have these receptions, and it was open bar, and my undergrad friends and I would just go, and we would get to drink wine with Robert Haas, C.D. Wright, Linda Gregerson. It was really special. And it was,
when I was an undergrad, if I heard you have that experience, I wouldn't have even known that it could be fun, how it could be fun or anything. So it's not like I just didn't have the opportunity. I didn't even have the wherewithal. If you told me that story, I would have fallen asleep. Yeah, and back at that age, I would have. Yep, interesting.
But I, you know, these poets would come. I remember especially like when Bob Haas came, he had this kind of like glow around him, and I was like, that might be like the poet glow or something. And I just remember when I got to be in the room with him afterwards and hear people talking to him and see how people talked to him, you know, with this kind of like awe, I was like, wow, that's something. Like, not that I wanted the awe, but like it reflected what he wrote, I guess. And like the things he was saying during the reading. So really my time at Cincinnati was when you were asking Michael about what pivoted to me towards like the grown-up world of creative writing, that was huge. And then I took a year off, and I went to my MFA programs. And I think it was also good to have a year off between undergrad and the MFA.
I think you wanted to get back to handling cadavers in airports.
I did. I never handled them. I did the paperwork. Oh, but, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a son who handles cadavers, but that's a different story.
I have a cousin who, for her job for a while, was to take the eyeballs out of cadavers for research. So
that's great.
Travels with her special spoon, I guess.
I hope that shows up in a poem.
Yeah, maybe. I haven't yet.
This special, but... this special spoon.
So
watch out for your soup.
So that's what a cool story.
Yeah, and it really is. It really is.
You know, look back and I think, well, actually, somebody you wrote about in your dissertation, you know, when I met her, it had an impression on me too. It's Rita Dove. And you'd be happy to hear that recently a student came out to me out of no place talking about Rita Dove. I was like, what?
Thank God.
Yeah, college junior talking about Rita Dove. You read it in class? And she hadn't read it in class. I don't know where she bumped into it, but I told her about.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys the name of a poet that I didn't know, but I was in Washington kind of stalking an author, this Irish monk, Mark Patrick Hederman, who I mentioned in our correspondence with our guest, Mr. Tunney, Mike. But I went to Washington, and my friend who's a Trappist monk and a poet, Father Isaac Slater, he and I spent a day with the poet Fanny Howe. Is that a name you know? She was wacky. She was great.
She's amazing.
Yeah. So we went to the National Gallery of Art. Father Isaac, the monk and his Trappist, he was just, you know, driving around town like a crazy man. She was just scared in this car in Washington, D.C. as we're going through Georgetown at 60 miles an hour with this mad monk poet. And I learned a lot about poetry that day. You know, we watched the pandas and the zoo and everything, but it was all with Fanny Howe that I started reading some of her poetry. Yeah.
Oh, I'm jealous. To spend a day with a monk and Fanny Howe.
Yeah, right from a morning through a really nice dinner in Georgetown, you know, about 12 hours.
Yeah. And so you should also read The Wedding Dress and The Winter Sun. Those are her essay collections. Amazing. Okay. They're like gorgeous.
The philosopher Richard Carney was there too. He's a really interesting.
Her parents were into like modernist theater and New Yeats and stuff, I think. And and her sister is Susan Howe, who is a scholar and wrote one of the best books on Emily Dickinson called My Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. And they're amazing. There's more poets in that family. But I love Fanny. Her recent book is Love and I think that's the title. John got it for me for my birthday, actually.
Her friend, you might like his poetry, but the monk, his name when he writes books of poetry is John Slater.
John Slater.
Imagination.
Yeah, he's got, that's right. In the first Jesus Imagination.
Maybe two. No, well, it's something like that.
Yeah, John Slater.
And then I just want to show our peoples. Oops, there's Katie's first book, Better Than Pink, which came out in 2018?
It came out in 2016. And it was December 2016. And Harlan came out in February 2017. I did not have any I didn't get to go and do a lot of readings for that book or talk, you know. I was like very subsumed with the precious end of pregnancy and the precious newborn days. So now that I've been doing some readings for Wolf Trees, I think back and, you know, I think about the kind of closed world of like that
Wolf Trees. Wolf Trees,
go on, get those right now. So before we talk more shop, why don't you read another poem?
Sure.
Maybe you could read Studies in Devotion.
Sure. And
what page is it on? I want to read along.
Studies in Devotion is on page 12.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, we'll follow this up with Michael has a really interesting connection to this poem. But I'll just say before I read it that It is partially ekphrastic of Raphael's Madonna di Foligno. Some part of the poem describes that painting, and this comes out of a time in my life, and also out of my and Jonathan's lives where we had some losses and we were praying for our children. So that's kind of the outward context of this poem. So, studies in devotion. He reaches for my insulin pump, the size of a strawberry, underneath my sleeve. He thinks it's me, the programmed opaque reservoir that feeds my blood in drips. Expecting it to yield like skin to his touch, he outlines the hard edges until enough is known for now. We slip into the pose of mother, we shift, sorry, into the pose of mother and slippery child in Raphael's Madonna di Foligno, the painting a doctor prescribed to me. Not for Jerome or his lion, not for Francis's hands, like winter branches singing to faraway shapes, not for John the Baptist, his Rod Stewart hair and wiry biceps, and not for the woman or the babe who squirms to sail out of her arms. My doctor, she was very good, directed my gaze to the children's faces surrounding Mary. They have become the clouds they float inside. Some look at her and some look at each other. Some have been reading James Wright and cup their sister's cheeks. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness. Others prefer Leonard Cohen. They are leaning out for love and they will lean that way forever. Look at them for a long time, a little each day, my doctor instructed, and I did, holding a screen in my lap in a Chicago flat. The man who commissioned the work kneels below them, caped in fur-lined red. Something fiery fell from the sky and into his house, but he lived. Paint me alone among the saints. Paint me in my gratitude. This happened years ago. On earth, they gather around the ground torn open by the disaster, a womb of nothingness that filled, healed shut, and now these green and yellow tufts grow there, as if dormant seeds were harrowed back to life. And in the middle, across his messenger's chest, a cherub holds a blank bronze plaque, still waiting for its words, the way the uninscribed can wait.
Beautiful, beautiful. And some of you might not know, but there's a quote from James Wright's, one of my favorite poems, James Wright's poem, A Blessing, which is one of an extraordinary poem. But here's the story, though. So when I read when I was going through the poems after Katie gave me the book a few weeks ago, I don't even think I was reading in order. I think I read Breast Milk, and then I just picked up the book and I see Madonna di Foligno. I'm like, okay, I'll read that one. And so I read it, and it got to the part where it says, the painting a doctor prescribed to me. That might sound like poetic license, that like a doctor's prescribing a painting to a patient. But I knew what it was because I know the doctor. It was crazy. Because when I was a Waldorf teacher, I was there. So another person we've had on the show, Mary Jo Oresti, who is my oldest son's Dylan's godmother. In fact, it's his birthday today. And her birthday tomorrow.
Happy birthday to Dylan.
Happy birthday. Right.
And, happy birthday, Mary Jo.
Mary Jo tomorrow.
And so when I first was learning to be Waldorf teacher, a lot of things they had me do is I would go work with Mary Jo. She did kind of Waldorf curative education for kids with learning disabilities or whatever, or who weren't quite in their bodies yet. And they had just come up with this treatment, I guess we can call it. They called it the Madonna treatment, where they would show, the full blown one is they would have a sequence of images from mostly Raphael's Madonnas, and they would also project onto the image the Madonna, so you get like a, almost a three dimensional experience of it, while playing the lyre, and. And last December, after my mother died, Mary Jo came over and she said, Michael, we should do the Madonna treatment for you and the kids. And so she came over, she did it. And I knew, and we had done it, I did it with her 30 years ago. And here I'm reading about the Madonna treatment in here. And I knew it was the doctor because the doctors who, two of them who brought this to the States were Ross and Andrea Rantea from Chicago. So I called Katie up right away. I said, girl, where'd this come from? This is Andrea Rantea, right?
Yep. And
lo and behold,
well, no, at first you said, like, crazy. What doctor are you talking about? I said, oh, Dr. Andrea Rantea. And like, then you finished my sentence. Because when I lived in Chicago, I found my way to her. And again, this was long before I met Michael. So it's just a way that like our paths were crossing before they even crossed.
Crazy story. Yeah.
And I saw her for several things. She's a wonderful anthroposophic doctor. And in that time of my life, like the poem starts out, with a child. The poem isn't clear if it's the speaker's child or someone else's. So I think the poem wants to kind of shift through different times and desires. But one of the things I struggled with, like in pregnancy, and was my diabetes. I have type 1 diabetes, and the book is a lot about that. So it starts out with that moment, but then it goes into the doctor saying, you know, you're prescribing to me this Madonna di Foligno, and I think I don't say it directly in the poem that the reason is, you know, praying for children, and you know, hoping for a healthy pregnancy, which she was also giving me some sun hormones for. That is what it was for. And it's amazing. And when Michael said, I know that doctor, I was just kind of blown away. Cause I also was very pleased with it as a poetic phrase, Michael, the painting a doctor prescribed to me, but she did. Yeah.
No, it's a great poetic phrase. When the story began, I thought maybe you were kind of, capturing Michael as a doctor that he prescribed that picture. I'm like, this is gonna be crazy. Yeah, but I love the idea. This lady has to take the Madonna treatment on the road, don't you think? And I don't mean that in a commercialized way, but you know, it's intuitively true. Okay, so a lot of people would just get it right away. Even if they thought a lot of this stuff was crazy, it makes a lot of sense.
Contemplate those images, something happens.
In effect. I can stand up.
We should copyright it, Mike. Steal it. Try to make some money for the Regeneration podcast.
Yeah.
Also, the lines from Leonard Cohen in that poem, Katie, from Suzanne, I argue that that's Michael. If we ever had a show on the most sociological songs ever, Leonard Cohen, Suzanne is the most sociological song ever written.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the song brings me to tears.
Yeah,
it's wild. It's his best.
I just love it. Have you heard Nina Simone sing it?
Yeah. Haunting.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that version too.
And your line, Katie, the winter branches singing to faraway shapes. I think that's my favorite.
Oh, thank you.
Winter branches singing to faraway shapes. I just thought that was so beautiful.
It's so much beautiful. And well, here's the thing. I mean, I reread the book again today, preparing for this evening. And there's this theme of diabetes that comes through it, but it stands against the other theme, which is motherhood, right? And breast milk and all the anxieties about fearing you won't be able to get pregnant and dealing with miscarriage and which is part of what this poem alludes to, right? And I think it's beautiful because it's I don't want to say vulnerable because it's such a hackneyed phrase sometimes, but there's such a vulnerability to it, and there's such an honesty to it, and it's so rare for me to encounter this this valorization of the feminine and of motherhood in poetry. And it's I can't wait to make Bonnie read it.
you would think it would be the central image in all of poetry. See, I don't read that much poetry. Well, but to an outsider, if I was playing Family Feud and they said central images in poetry, I'd probably say like tree definitely, and mother and child would be number two. Yep.
And it's just beautiful. And plus no, I mean, and I told you before, when I read your poems, I hear them in your voice.
Thank you. And, you know, I think you're not wrong to say vulnerable. It's good. I think, you know, I'm always thinking about roots, and vulnus is Latin for wound. Yeah. And, you know, woundable, you know, like the things that can pierce us. And I think the poetry is always really open and alive to that. So,
yeah. I mean, just such an extraordinary poem. So much in there. So much. So what, I mean, I don't know if this is even worth asking, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What is it that you think that wanted you, that drove you or inspired you to move in this direction of talking about your diabetes and motherhood here?
When I was diagnosed, it was a late onset diagnosis, and I had seen some of my family members struggle with diabetes. My maternal grandfather and one of my maternal first cousins who was diagnosed when she was 12. And it was just such a huge life change. I mean, it's still hard to articulate like how many times of the day I'm thinking about my diabetes. You know, it's like, it's really like, well, I'm going to take this walk. So do I need to take a snack? What's my blood sugar now? How much insulin do I take? And there's so much advanced technology that helps me with all of that. Like, I'm so grateful for it to be alive at a time, like, you know, to think of, you know, just over a century ago, it would have been a death sentence, period. And it's a really,
I was going to ask that question. Wild. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's very old. I mean, the Greeks, ancient Greeks knew it. The Egyptians knew it. The Egyptians actually have some wild, cause I tried to do a lot of reading, you know, around, but it appears in ancient, one of the oldest Egyptian medical texts. And they have this wild recipe for, trying to, cure it, which involves like hops and water from the bird pond. And it's just, it's really actually, it's a poetic list all on its own, like the list to cure diabetes. But, so it's really old and it's been, you know, ravaging bodies for a long time. And certainly in the 20th century in American context, type 2 diabetes is a little bit different, but that's kind of a different story. So it was just such a huge shift in my consciousness that and I think when I was writing poems, I thought there was always a part of me that was like, well, put that away. Like the diabetes doesn't belong in the poems. Like when you write poems, it will be about other better, or not like, you know, necessarily optimistic things, but like easier things or less granular, like medical things. But then as I was trying to get pregnant and as I experienced miscarriage, you know, I knew that the diabetes was part of being the best diabetic I could be, was going to be part of being the best pregnant mother I could be, because it's actually really an intense experience, because, you know, you and the baby share blood. And so if your blood sugar is high, the baby's blood sugar is high, and that can lead to problems for the child and the fetus. And so being pregnant as a diabetic is exceptionally stressful, and stress, guess what, can raise your blood sugar. So it's just an intense experience. And, you know, there, I don't know if you've seen Steel Magnolias with Julia Roberts. There's like, I think for a long time, and Sally Field, like the, you know, Julia Roberts is a type 1 diabetic in that movie. And I think for a long time for diabetic moms, it was like a cautionary tale, like, no, you know, pregnancies aren't good, you know, for diabetic mothers. And it's just been in the past, I think, few decades that care has become advanced enough that, you know, you can do it safely, but it's really, you have to focus on it all the time. It has to be a constant priority. And when I had Harlan, and then when I had Arthur, and I was starting to write about it, I think it was just because it just took so much of my attention and heart that it had to come out in a poem. But I didn't know how. I didn't know how to make it come out in a poem. I didn't know how to approach writing about something that felt not very capital P poetic. And then, you know, my father-in-law was visiting one day, and he pointed at a tree in our neighborhood that's clearly one of the oldest trees in the neighborhood, and had been there long before the neighborhood was a neighborhood, when it was still farmland. And he said, oh, that's a wolf tree. And I said, what? What is a wolf tree? And I, you know, it's not a super common phrase, but it is more common than you might think. Like, there's, you know, usage of it across the country. And it's either a tree that was not cut down when the rest of the forest was cut down to make way for farmland, and it was set aside as kind of a shade tree, for the animals grazing, or that tree, then the farms failed and a new woodland grew up around it. And so it's the oldest tree in a younger forest. Either way, it's, I guess how I came to it was that it was a remnant of a former ecology. Like it's like a landmark of the past. And I guess thinking of myself as someone who survives with a disease that would have killed them like 100 years ago, something in that connected me with the wolf tree. And then when I started writing about wolf trees, that's when the diabetes started. The writing about the diabetes started coming out, but it was also totally involved with my becoming a mother. And I think the idea of the wolf tree is, there's something that's really good for the forest. Like the health of the forest is not kind of what was an earlier forestry idea of like maintenance and cutting down the old trees and sweeping it out and only having a clean, tidy forest. And you need mess. You need like the old rotting wolf trees because you need like all the generative minerals and the places for animals to live. And so there's something maternal about a wolf tree that wrapped up in that. So
as I said, that there's a long wolf tree sequence in here, which is just beautiful, beautiful. Would you like to read one of those?
Well, I could pick one to read. so they alternate lineated, like free verse. It is mostly free verse or prose poems. The last one is actually in blank verse tercets. I was having a really hard time with the last section, and then I started thinking, well, I'm going to write it in a loose blank verse and make it tercets. And then it came together all of a sudden. So I could read, you know, I don't get to read section 8 very much. So maybe I'll read that actually, because it ends with a joke. And I listed my family earlier who had had diabetes. I didn't mention my paternal grandmother also had it. So it's on both sides of my family. Section 8 talks about my neighborhood, but also conversations with my grandmother when I was pregnant, and then experiences she had in her job as a maternity ward nurse for many years. And then it ends with a joke she told me. So I'll read section 8, and it's on page 37 of the book. "You're a little long in the tooth to be having a baby," my grandmother chuckled at me. "Wolf trees don't have teeth anymore. In fact, their gummy open gullets are more like wombs. The sparrows know something like this, they who built a nest in the growling mouth of the dragon statue down the street, flying freely in and out." She grew up in the Depression and usually does not laugh at her own jokes. Like a wolf tree, her face is the craggiest kind of beautiful. An old diabetic, she'd call herself, with some bitterness. She is not many years away from becoming a snag, a decayed and hollow trunk all the conservation biologists are now likewise advising don't cut down, precisely because they're dead, they shelter life. I don't think she was being mean. I think she likes saying things other people don't, to preserve certain turns of phrase, long in the tooth, or I won't have no truck with so-and-so. I think she was worried. Head nurse of the maternity ward for decades, she once delivered 10 babies in one night. Once a 15-pound baby. The mother was an old diabetic, she said, laying every ounce of blame on the body she had seen inside. And the baby? Not good to look at. I think for all her worries, she likes the spirit of a good surprise, like her remark once that Sean Connery probably has plenty of good sperm left. Another virtue of the wolf tree, in their old age and breadth, they are prolific seed producers. Or, like a watermelon roast, hearing that I attended a bonfire on a beach with a group of friends, she asked if we had a watermelon roast. What's that? Oh, it's when guys and girls have a fire and someone throws a watermelon in and it explodes and everybody goes into the bushes and has a piece.
Really grandma.
That was my grandma. That was my Baba.
Grandma Salty.
She was the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. She just passed in 2021.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. So I think I'd mostly finished the book, but yeah, she was a wonder.
Sounds great. It's wonderful. Oh, so now once upon a time we talked. In fact, Katie was here with the boys for Michaelmas, and she heard that Dylan was studying the Iliad in school. And she gave him a mini course right there in the barn on the Iliad, and he was blown away. He was stoked. And my son, 14. But Katie has been working on a translation of the Iliad.
I have.
And that's been it's a long term project, because it has to be, right?
Yeah, it's changed in a lot of ways. And now it's part translation and then part creative commentary and part vignettes of ancient audience members. So what the structure will roughly look like is I'll have a section of a translation of the Iliad, and then I'll have a little sort of lyric prose piece, sort of Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities. I kind of want them to have that kind of vibe. Where I imagine an ancient person experiencing and thinking about the Iliad in antiquity. So mostly archaic age, I'm thinking, like kind of pre-literacy, pre books and writing. So yeah. So I love the Iliad. It's one of my favorite things. You know, I think I was one of those kids who grew up thinking the Odyssey was so cool and fun, and like that was kind of my favorite one, and I didn't really think much about the Iliad. And then when I started reading it in Greek and during my PhD program with another amazing mentor of my life, Marion Hopman, a wonderful classicist and not a poet, but I think she made my brain a better poet brain just by studying with her. Because she had so many insights to the Greek and into metaphor, and just she's amazing. But yeah, but now the Iliad is my favorite thing. Obviously, I still love the Odyssey, but the Iliad is, I don't know, I think it's like my lifelong obsession. So,
and everything about this book was your idea, Katie?
The current project, yeah, like is this
okay, my, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so I'm trying to, because I think I don't want it to be just a regular translation, because there have been several of those out lately, especially by women, which is very cool. So I think just even sort of thinking about publication wise, like I didn't want it to be, well, here's another translation, you know, of the Iliad. It'll be a little bit different. It'll be more of an invitation, even though that's another word that gets overused, I think, Michael, but it'll be more of like an invitation into the Iliad and maybe its ancient contexts. That's what I hope.
So why the Iliad?
Because I think there's just so much humanity in the Iliad, so much beauty. The epic similes are some of my favorite things in the world, how they show us glimpses of a peaceful agrarian world, like reflected through the lens of war, and the speeches, the characters, the poetry. I feel like there's like, sometimes there's just three words in the Iliad I just like spend time staring at and thinking about. Just, and you know, the original experience of it would have been so different. You know, they would never have experienced in the archaic age, there wouldn't have been a 3-day long performance of the Iliad. They would have heard short episodes at a time. And I think when students sit down with like this whole book by themselves and think of it, reading it all by themselves, it's so alien from how its origins. And so I kind of want to bring people back into like an episodic community of hearing it.
Nice. In fact, this is not related, but I often show students, there's a from Star Trek, The Next Generation, when Captain Picard tells the story of Gilgamesh. It's only about a 3-minute scene, but it is packed with meaning and humanity, you know, just because, I mean, that's where it's all at. It's the story. And I think I might be wrong, but you may have been talking with Gabriel about the scene when Hector comes back home, which is one of my favorite scenes in all of literature.
And one of the only happy, one of the glimpses we get of like a happy family who, where the husband and wife clearly love and respect each other. And the way they talk to each other is just so persuasive and compelling and heartbreaking because everyone knows how it will end.
Everyone knows how it's going to end.
No, Mike, are you an Iliad or an Odyssey guy?
Me?
Really the only familiarity, I've never read it, but it's, I was thinking, but it would just sound like trying to butt in because I really don't know that much, but it would be Simone Weil's essay on Iliad, you know, and the power of force. And that, it's funny because that essay I've read several times, probably not for the last 15 years, but it's not helping me even remember, you know, there's not too much I can, but I remember being blown away by that essay, you know.
Well, even Greek, you know, unwilling, you know, is such a word that reoccurs in the Iliad and the idea that like this is happening by force, you know. So that's a great essay. If you read it, if you want to go to the Iliad, I recommend Carolyn Alexander's translation.
Okay.
It came out in 2016. My favorite of all time is Richmond Latimore's from like the mid 20th century because it's very, this might be again another overused word, but it's very stately. It's like, it's very, I don't know, I love it. But the, but students, it's not as accessible to students as I think Carolyn Alexander still keeps the poetry and the rhythm, but it's just a little bit more easy for them to read.
Great information.
Yeah. Well, it's weird with translations. I mean, you always think the best one's the first one you fell in love with, which is usually the first one, right? Exactly. And then you read other ones, so it's not the same.
Never the same. I know. It's like that scene in Annie Hall when he tries to recreate the lobster date, you know, the, and he's like, it never works out the same as it did with Annie. And I'm that way with Constantine Cavafy and Ray Dalvin. Like, that's my favorite translation of Cavafy. But John's favorite is Keeley and Sherard. And so we like argue about it. But that's the, because it's the first one we read.
I know what that's like. I mean, I think the first Rilke translation I read was probably Stephen Mitchell's. Stephen Spender did one. And I went to read that. I was like, wow, this is lame. But
yeah, right?
Probably not. But other people are like, this is the best one.
Yeah, the Germans would be a good example of that for me, how it's definitely the first one I read. I just can't be moved into another one. It's a whole world each time. And interesting. I'm going to want you to read Negative at some point because you said you have things to say about it too, Katie.
So why don't we
read
that now? Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So one of the nice things about the pandemic was how many walks we took as a family. And we were just out all the time, walking through woods, changing diapers. It was a lot of outside time. And that was one of the best parts about it for us. And so one of our favorite places to walk in Ann Arbor is Barton Pond and by the dam. And there's a little bridge over the river and it gets graffitied, you know. And so we would walk by and there is, someone had graffitied in blue cursive, very beautiful blue cursive, the word sea, S-E-A. So, and it was right when you were looking over the Huron, and it's very Midwestern, deciduous, like brown, green, like there's nothing maritime about it. But there was something so beautiful about seeing the word sea in blue over the Huron. And it just felt like, oh, I live at a place where poets live or something like that. Like I loved looking at that and seeing that word on the bridge. And so that was one of my favorite things. And then there was a point in the pandemic when everyone was getting really tired and frustrated, like what is going on? This is awful. And on one of those days, I walked on that bridge and someone had come along and crossed out the word sea.
Oh.
And I like screamed. I was so upset because it was like—
And you say uncannily equal to the word it came to cancel is the line for the poem that I like best.
Oh,
uncannily, okay. This X. It's never been a better use of uncanny, you know, uncannily equal to the word it came to cancel. Yeah, it's great.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
But that was something the poem brought me to, like thinking about it that way. But yeah, I'll read it. So that's, this is on page 3, page 9, Negative. To whoever crossed out with a blue X the word C, written in white cursive on the top iron guardrail of my second favorite bridge over the Huron River. Of course it's not. Were you angry? Were you sad? Are you a disgruntled former employee of the earth? You have company. I know some walks can get you nowhere. I've seen one child take away a toy from another, not because they wanted the lamb or train or drum, but they saw the other kid so happy with it. And a no erupts, a need to negate what might be someone's favorite thing. When I first saw what you did, I yelled across the water, startling swans with their bottoms up through air and beaks deep in dioxane-plumed mud back to the surface. Their hearts can't say what's been done to them either. And why did you use such a pastel Marion shade of blue? Why does your ex have that strange sense of elegance, patience, uncannily equal to the word it came to cancel? Almost as if it were you who first wrote C in a burst of jubilant heresy, a fit of 21st century Duchampian reverence, a mood where the world could be different, when water itself could be baptized, revised. Then came a day, terribly certain that no better difference is coming, a day to recant, not erase your work, a day like today. I feel it too.
Really great. You know, and Michael too, I thought Katie, you know, one time, I think Michael came up, you know, we have all these church wars. We're always talking about the church wars on this podcast, and yes, rad treads and everything. But the, you know, I'm always interested in like the way the word holiness is used, but the other one is the way the word reverence is used. And I remember, you know, because reverence can mean just throwing up a lot of mystic mumbo jumbo. And everybody goes, I want that in liturgy, you know, that's reverent. But Michael, you described reverence one time on the podcast saying like each year when you read the story, it was on Michaelmas, but you read the story of St. Francis of Assisi. And it was this tradition and seeing the look in people's eyes. But you write, Katie, reverence, a mood where the world could be different, when water mm-hmm. itself could be baptized, revised. And somebody who had some poetic sensibilities, in some song by Peter Gabriel, he talks about the washing of the water. But you're mm-hmm. saying the water that could be, you know, water itself could be baptized. That's very evocative of reverence, you know, and I have to sit with that for a long time. What did it capture for you? What were you saying there?
Well, I guess the idea that the initial vision of writing C mm-hmm. over the brown, well, the dark waters of the Huron, was like, I can reimagine this, you know, I can recast this, and this water maybe has the soul of water from somewhere far away or long ago. It just felt like such an imaginative recasting.
Yeah.
And I think something about that reverence of like transformation, possibility, something about that speaks to reverence.
Yeah. I was also reading, you know, people don't know, a lot of people who haven't seen the Great Lakes. So you're talking about the Huron River, probably doesn't look like the Mediterranean. But on the other hand, Lake Huron at the north where it meets the Mackinac, right? That really? People are amazed at that water. They don't know that it looks like the Mediterranean, the water around, you know, Mackinac Island. So both Hurons were kind of playing with me. And when I saw the word sea, I saw the blue of Lake Huron from like St. Ignace or something. And, you know, it was evocative in that way. And then when I thought of, you know, water being baptized, I thought of the Mediterranean kind of waters and things.
Mm-hmm. No, let me shift a little bit to process. So, I mean, because I'm hoping that maybe some students or younger people, or my daughter Zelly, will watch this and want to know what's your kind of process in writing poetry? How does it happen? Because I, you know, I know my experience, but I'm just, what's it like for you?
It's really a gift. I mean, and not that I have the gift. It's something that comes, like a gift comes, and like a phrase will appear, or something will stir me, and I need to write it down, and then eventually the poem builds up around that. Like I rarely sit down thinking like I'm going to write a poem about this. Because I feel like that doesn't make good poems, I don't think, when you have a topic. But no, it's an image. It's a visual clash of some kind of something I see and something I think, and then I have to write it down. And some poems take a long time, like over many, many revisions. I just had a poem that was, so when, before we would have met you in 2016, Jonathan and I took a trip to Ireland, and I had a poem written about a graveyard we visited in Carrigaholt. And I just revised that poem again, like this year. So some poems like go and sit for a while and then, you know, come back with like I choose a different form or a different approach to how to revise it. And then something new comes out of that. But what starts it? I mean, it always has felt like a little bit of something coming to me from beyond. And I was just reading, Lucille Clifton is a poet I love, and Ross Gay wrote the foreword to her recently published collection, The Light. And he wrote about how so many people in creative writing try to talk about find your voice, find the voice that's all yours. Whereas Clifton, she too would talk about it as something like, it's not mine. I don't know why, but it comes to me and it's not mine. And so it's a really interesting distinction of, I don't feel like I own it in any way.
Now, didn't she die a couple of years ago?
She did, yeah.
Did you ever meet her?
You know, I did not get to meet her, sadly, but I got to be at a reading very shortly after her death that her family, her children, gave in Chicago, and that was really special. So,
well, we had her come to Marygrove when I was teaching there.
And really? That's amazing.
She was funny, and she was talking about, because, you know, she was older, and she was talking about when she was giving a reading at some Catholic college, and she goes, and there I was talking to all these nuns about the spiritual life, and I told my daughter, shoot me before I kill again. she was a riot. She was a lovely human being.
I wish I could have met her. I mean, the stories I hear, yeah.
She was full of life, that woman.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite people we brought in. We brought in quite a few people.
Yeah.
Here's my question. It's been bugging me lately about the writing of poetry, and, you know, I get poems sent to me to edit or something. What's the toughest part about writing poetry? Or maybe not, or finishing poetry, put it that way.
Maybe it's hoping people like it. Maybe that's something that you that you like have to not ultimately care about. Because I think another part of my process is like, it does feel like a way that I pray or that I praise, and that I'm trying to acknowledge and be grateful for some, you know, divine love or some guiding force I feel over the world. And and so if that's the service, you know, if you're in service of something bigger, like poets can have egos, you know, poets can really have egos. And so probably like maybe one of the toughest parts of writing poetry is like not having it attached to anything about yourself so much.
Now, here's the thing. Here's my question. It's totally so prosaic. What about punctuation? Isn't it the toughest thing about writing poetry? It is for me.
That's so funny. Are you, you like to be without it, or?
I don't know.
The existence of it.
You know what I mean? Sometimes, mm-hmm. You know, it's just, and
grammar. I mean, Jonathan will be like, you read too much Latin. You write these long sentences and nobody wants to read them. when I was getting this book, when I was going through its revision, when it was getting proofread, the editor, one of the readers, who will rename, I don't know who it was. It's anonymous to me. My editor knows who they are. There are several instances where I use, what's called, what was the phrase they used? They called it a needs washed phrase. So I guess it's very Appalachian, and I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, which is at the tip, you know, of Appalachia. And it's something that's very much in my language, like, like in a poem on page, let's see if I can find it. Page 11, like lake water wanting parted, or a barn that needed burning. Like there were several things where I'm using this like not correct syntax, and it should be like wants to be parted or needs to be burned, right? And it's, but it's, I guess like someone has studied it and they called it the needs washed phrase, because that's like a way that they commonly saw it used in Appalachia. And the anonymous editor was like, we need to cut this out. Like, this is like subliterate. Like they actually use the phrase, like, it's not elegant. It's not, it's not, it needs to go. And I had to fight like kind of hard for it. Like that, it's part of my language. It's part of like, my brain thinks that way and I don't want to cut it out, you know? So my editor eventually, after three rounds of email, my editor, who is amazing, Alex Peppel, God bless you. Like, you're amazing. But he eventually was like, okay, Katie, you can keep your subliterate.
It's a great story.
You can, who you calling subliterate? Yeah. It's interesting. Because it's kind of mysterious. The whole process of making poems is pretty mysterious.
Maybe a quick question, though, is that... you know, one of the, when they wade into the murky waters of Rudolf Steiner, right, or especially in the hands of Owen Barfield, that, and some of our listeners might be interested, and you can only say what you want to say, but like, when I'm explaining to people the case for the evolution of consciousness, you know, quite often it would boil down to, again, in the hands of Owen Barfield, that for Homer, the muse was something outside, sees somebody, it felt completely other, and now the evolution is such that in a person of genius or in a poet, you know, the voice, the muse, it's now in you, such it's where Katie is most I Katie, but also something different. Mm-hmm. From your understanding of Greek and so forth, does that evolution of consciousness pass muster?
Mm.
Or does that say it misunderstands one, you know, the whole thing? Because it sounds pretty cool, right?
But
to a poet, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think my answer is yes and no, because that is definitely the convention. And it's definitely a convention that I think is true. Like something bigger than you overtakes you and you are in its thrall and you are in its service in some way. And like inspiration, right? It breathes through.
And it
you.
Might early on, it might push out the personality.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The thing I would add though, in terms of like an ancient Greek epic poetry context, is that those poets were training from a young age to memorize large swaths of poetry. So the convention goes that they can grow up and say, muse, speak to me. I am your chosen one. Like, so I like, yes, you know the story, but I'm your chosen vessel. Mm-hmm. The pragmatic part of it though, is that they would have been trained from a young age to memorize all of those poems. And they would have had the freedom to tweak and change different occasions, different strategies, different things they wanted to highlight. If they wanted to highlight a marriage, or if they wanted to highlight a funeral, maybe that would like change what they chose to say. So yes, there's the muse, but it's also intense training in such a way that maybe it still does do what you said, that it pushes out the personality, the ego, but it's not as if, you know, someone can be walking around like, so Hesiod in the beginning of Theogony famously says, the muses came to me, I was a shepherd on the mountain, and they said, you know, will we pick you, you know, here's your laurel, here's your staff. And they also insult him, they say, shepherds, merest bellies. And then they say, interestingly, we know how to tell the truth, but we also know how to tell lies that sound true. So even the muses are very into casting suspicion upon themselves. But I would say that it's not the case that like someone like say in their 20s who has never recited epic poetry before could be overtaken by the muse and just start spewing epic. Like,
and I'm thinking of the Sibyls here or something, right? The ancient Sibyls.
Yeah, no, it would have been, working, practicing to memorize the equivalent of, you know, just enormous, what we now have as books, was all in their heads. And that's incredible. You know, that's just really something we can hardly imagine. But Seth Schein, who's an excellent classicist, now retired from UCLA, he said, like, the Iliad is one of the oldest poems we have, but it itself is the product of thousands of years of poetry and of poetic tradition. Like it's the culmination really of like so much training and shifting over time. So,
and I think what you're saying, it's, you know, I know this from being a musician as well as being a poet. People think they can just, you know, I've never read any poetry, but I'm a poet now and I'm writing poetry. And it's like, oh, isn't that charming? I mean, you wouldn't hand them a violin and say, let it rip.
Right. That's why, you know, who would we have on the show, Michael, who loved Amadeus? And I dislike the movie Amadeus for that reason. It makes it look like genius is easy. Who we had on?
I don't remember who that was.
Like the Mozart, just wrote it all without working.
But even with Mozart, I mean, he trained from a very young age.
Right. That's my point. Yeah.
But I think, so I've been playing music forever. And when I was 18, I was pretty precocious as a musician.
Surprised.
But these older guys would say, man, you're good, but you haven't paid your dues.
Yep.
And there's a big difference between how I was playing when I was 18 and even when I was 20, 24. There was a huge difference. I mean, you do have to go through a kind of training, even if it's not a formal training. You have to. Mm-hmm. I in fact, at my niece's wedding a couple months ago, I ran into my best friend growing up, and we wrote 200 songs together between the ages of 16 and 26. And we talked about it. It was, you know, we wrote a lot of crappy songs, but it was an apprenticeship that we went through.
Yep.
And it really prepared me to be a poet.
We don't talk about it much, but in my line of work, you see the same thing. It's pastoring. You know, I work with so many priests, I've worked with monks, but like the people who just with experience kind of get it, it is a work of art. You know, the way they can enter a situation, understand what's going on, say the right thing. It's totally beautiful. Same thing. Me when I was young, I thought I had it. And I was, oh my God, that we're saved from ourselves is the greatest gift we could ever get.
We develop a sense of intuition about it.
Yeah.
But it's through training. You know, so it's an interesting thing. We got all this training, but if you rely on all the training, it's stiff. Mm-hmm. And there's something else that goes on where you have to let intuition or inspiration work as well, which is and you see this with jazz musicians all the time too, right?
Yeah.
But we're getting long in the tooth here. So
long in the tooth.
Wrapping it up. Wrap it up. Why don't we have you read The Nipple Shield of Achilles? Speaking of breastfeeding and Greek literature.
Yeah, that would be great. This is one of the last poems in the book, and it's on page 82. Mm-hmm. And to preface it, I would say that the poem talks about this, but if you're not familiar with the therapies of nursing, there is a little item called a nipple shield that lactation consultants will give mothers who are having a difficult time nursing. And I've taught the Iliad many times, and I love the scene where Hephaestus makes the shield of Achilles, and it's just gorgeous. And it's kind of this cosmic cycle of everything on the shield at once. And I also love Auden's poem, The Shield of Achilles, which has such a dark upending of all the difficult beauty of the shield. So I think a lot about the Shield of Achilles. So when the lactation consultant gave me the nipple shield, I immediately was like, the nipple shield of Achilles. Like it just was in my head, like instantly, because it is such an odd phrase.
What does a nipple shield do?
Well, the poem.
My wife and I, we've had four babies. I'm trying to think.
Well, maybe she didn't need one. I had a terrible time, as the poem says, when I was starting to nurse. And so it thinks about that. And then it also thinks about the idea that Achilles' mother Thetis is immortal. And part of the beauty that I spoke of earlier, that the humanity of the Iliad comes through, I think that in antiquity, so many mothers, wives, sisters, daughters would have lost young men to war in various ways. And so even though Thetis is a goddess, her grief is so fresh because she hasn't yet had to experience mortality in a meaningful way. And so when she's thinking about losing her son, it's as like as if the oldest experience is made brand new and painful. And that is part of what I love thinking about ancient women listening to Thetis grieve, that even though she's a goddess and they're human, that there's enormous reciprocity there. Yeah, I think then I'll read it. The nipple shield of Achilles. When Thetis mourns her son before he is dead, she says, "I raised him like a tree in a sloping orchard. Or maybe I nourished him like a tree. Or fattened, cherished, gave strength to, gave suck to. I had a terrible time when I started nursing. Ravaged was the word my chest sang like an epic simile where a beaten donkey keeps destroying crops while the bloodshed rages on. Not only because of the baby's tongue tie it took three lactation consultants to notice, but also they all agreed because of his mother's nipples. My ex used to tease me. They were tiny. Platitudes, not obelisks. He'd touch them. We'd tussle. I'd protest my greatness. I almost called him. Hey, guess what I need? When I was given a small piece of silicone called a nipple shield, it protected my skin and gave the baby more bulk to suck. Where is the epic poem of childbirth? My friend Ruth has wondered. And just yesterday, I heard Madeline Miller ask the same. To help myself heal, I also purchased breast shells, which sounded like something an ocean nymph might wear. Ah me, my sorrow, the bitterness in this best of childbearing. Thetis is, remember, immortal. I imagine her gliding onto the plain of war to say what no extant epic would have wanted her to say. Put that down right now. And in reply, I hear Robert Moses in 1950s New York yelling at Jane Jacobs and her opposition to build a highway through Greenwich Village. There is nobody against this. Nobody, 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 but a bunch of mothers. I'd lick the nipple shield and stick it on, and soon I didn't need it. I'd think of Thetis nursing her gleaming son, a milk-drunk bundle, and her hair floating in the underwater breeze. After all, I am a mammal. This is how I work, how he increases, how I battle my imperfection, his mortality.
Beautiful, Katie. Beautiful. Really? Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us today. So where can people follow your work? Is there a place to follow you?
I thank you both so much for having me. This has been such a lovely conversation, and thanks for the podcast and all the great conversations you have here. My website is katiehartsock.com. I am not on any social media and haven't been
great credit.
Right. It is.
But there's updates on my website, and yeah.
Okay. Well, this has been a real blessing, and we're really so you joined us.
I feel the same. Thank you so much.
See you soon, I hope.
I hope so.
And thanks everybody for listening to the Regeneration Podcast. We'll see you again next week. Until then.